Love the night? Reach for Zin After Dark, a limited cocktail-inspired series for those who get up when the sun goes down. Try Zin's Mojito, Spiced Cider, and Espresso Martini nicotine pouches. Find them at select retailers. Available while supplies last. Zin After Dark. Bring on the night. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
Running a Shopify store and drowning in shipping chaos? ShipStation can fix this for you. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels with advanced automation, batch processing, and shipping discounts that a single platform just doesn't offer. Like discounts up to 90% off major carriers. See how ShipStation can make shipping for your Shopify store better. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
Love the night? Reach for Zin After Dark, a limited cocktail-inspired series for those who get up when the sun goes down. Try Zin's Mojito, Spiced Cider, and Espresso Martini nicotine pouches. Find them at select retailers. Available while supplies last. Zin After Dark. Bring on the night. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
If you run a Shopify store, listen up. Shopify has got you covered for selling, but when your shipping volume grows and you're juggling multiple plugins just to get orders out the door, you need tools that can keep up. Stop duct taping your shipping workflow and use the tools that work better together, like Shopify and ShipStation. Think of ShipStation as Shopify's dedicated shipping partner. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels to save you time and money by automating the entire order fulfillment process, from syncing your orders all the way through inventory management and returns. Automate the rate browser to select the lowest rates on shipments, with discounts up to 90% off major carriers like USPS, UPS, and FedEx. No wonder businesses that use ShipStation grow 3 times faster on average and ship 15 times more orders. See how ShipStation can help you scale and boost your Shopify sales. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
Welcome back to Hashtag Sisters-in-Law with Kimberly Atkins Store, Jill Winebanks, Barb McQuaid, and me, Joyce Vance. Today we'll be talking about the latest developments with the January 6th committee, the trouble with witnesses, including the Steve Bannon trial and Lindsey Graham summons to Georgia, and the latest developments as President Biden tries to marshal federal resources to protect abortion. And as always, we look forward to answering your questions. We know you've had a lot of them this week at the end of the show. But first, before we get started, Kim, I wanted to talk about a piece that you wrote in the Boston Globe this week that really hit home with me. You know which piece I'm talking about. Yeah. Do you want to tell us about it?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It happened when I was running errands and I decided to hop on the subway this week for the first time in 2.5 years, thinking, okay, I like making that choice instead of calling an Uber. It's more sustainable and it's a better thing to do. But I have to say, it was really horrifying seeing the number of people who are still choosing, even on something like a subway train, to go unmasked at a time where we know COVID subvariants are running rampant. They're really not being stopped, even if for those who are vaccinated or have had infections before. And it just really made me feel uncomfortable. And I just thought to myself, wow, I really wish I lived in a world where the collective experience of our society going through a deadly pandemic would make us more likely to want to protect each other, even if you think you're going to be fine, to want to do that for your neighbor. And that really isn't the case. And so I talked to some medical experts who basically confirmed what I was fearing, is that this pandemic is far from over. It could even get worse. But the fact that all the mitigation efforts now are so difficult, if not impossible, to reimpose. So everybody's on their own. And that really made me sad. And especially, I have asthma. I don't want COVID. To my knowledge, I've never caught it. I've never had a positive COVID test. But I don't want to start now because that could have really big implications for me and my family. And I just wish others felt that way, Joyce.
It makes so much sense to me. Jill, have you thought about this issue too? How do you react to that?
I react pretty much like Kim does. I am being much more cautious than other people. I am masking. And with the new variant, the B5, it's contagious outdoors. And so that's a whole new thing where even at the farmer's market, I'm putting on a mask again because I want to be safe and I want to keep other people safe. And I'm visiting my goddaughter and her family, and they just had a wedding, and many of the people there tested positive. So they all tested before I came here to make sure that it was safe for me to be here. And I think, I hope our listeners are taking adequate precautions because we love you all and we want you to stay healthy and stay with us. And I think it's time to go back. I was particularly disappointed with our governor, who may have let his presidential ambitions get in the way. And he is now taking away many of the precautions that have been in place for college students, for example. And I know people are getting tired of the restrictions, and so am I. And I'm doing things that I wouldn't have done before, but I'm doing them masked. And so I think masks are really the answer.
Barb, what about you? I know you, like me, have been very careful throughout. How is this all making you feel?
Yeah, the same. I read Kim's piece and really found it to speak to me. I really just find it bewildering. You know, I try not to be judgmental. I know everybody has their own situation to deal with, but I wear a mask everywhere. And, you know, where I live in Ann Arbor, I go to university events. Most people are masked. In our courthouse, masking has recently become optional, but many people are still wearing them. And so when I get into other places, the grocery store, or I was at a dinner the other night, and I'm often the only one wearing a mask. And I want to say, am I the only one reading these news reports about variants being up? I actually had COVID fairly recently, and I'm over it, but I'm still wearing a mask because, you know, it isn't about yourself. It's about being a spreader to others. And I have elderly family members and just strangers, kids, other people in the community, right? I mean, the way to prevent the spread is by wearing masks. And I hear your point, Jill, about people getting tired of it. I'm tired of it. But, you know, it's like saying, well, we got tired of wearing seatbelts. You know, we wore them for a couple of years. Yeah. And then, exactly. You know, who wants to wear that seatbelt? So I don't wear it anymore. Like, I think we got to wear it. And, you know, we wear the mask until it's over. It's really not that hard. And so I'm mostly bewildered why people don't wear them. And so, you know, listeners, we respect your freedom, but, you know, mask up to show your love for others.
And I love your analogy. That's a great analogy to seatbelts. And it is so contagious now. All of my friends are, you know, double boosted and wear masks and are taking all kinds of precautions. And several of them have gotten COVID recently. Yeah. It just seems to be really spreading fast. So I really hope people will listen to your advice, Barb.
And right now, this subvariant seems to be producing overall, not in every case, but overall mild symptoms. People are still dying from COVID, but the majority of people. But you know, one thing that the experts that I talked to in writing the story said to me is, well, we don't know what BA7 or BA9 or BAX will bring. Uh-huh. Maybe those will bring more severe infections that are also still infecting people who have been infected before or who are vaccinated, which is why letting our guard down now is just not a good idea.
You know, we vacationed in Portugal and it was such a calculated risk to fly. In Portugal, virtually everybody is vaccinated. And we planned a trip where we did things like, you know, being on a boat going down the river with just our one other couple group of friends. But we knew flying was a risk. But so here's the horrible thing. We fly, we get home, we're fine, we test. Our youngest kid got COVID while we were gone. He called us the first day. He was positive. He and his group of friends have gone 2.5 years and never gotten positive. They all went up to Suwannee for the 4th of July, came home, all positive. So we've got him down in the basement and we're very fierce. Don't you dare come upstairs. We don't want you to give us COVID. And y'all, my husband caught COVID from him. Tested positive this morning. So I think my time has come, and I think everything that you said, Kim and Jill and Barb's wisdom holds, right?
we can't live in a paranoid way. Sometimes we have to do stuff like go to Portugal and hope that our kid at home won't get us sick.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's no reason not to wear a mask. It's just such an easy thing to do.
Right.
Love the night? Reach for Zen After Dark, a limited cocktail-inspired series for those who get up when the sun goes down. Try Zen's Mojito, Spiced Cider, and Espresso Martini nicotine pouches. Find them at select retailers, available while supplies last. Zen After Dark. Bring on the night. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
Running a Shopify store and drowning in shipping chaos? ShipStation can fix this for you. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels with advanced automation, batch processing, and shipping discounts that a single platform just doesn't offer. Like discounts up to 90% off major carriers. See how ShipStation can make shipping for your Shopify store better. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
This week, the January 6th committee had another blockbuster hearing, this time focused on the role of domestic extremism in the planning and violence of the 6th. Although Representative Cheney's surprise ending, hinting at possible witness tampering by the former president, got almost as much attention as the video and live testimony about the events of the 6th. Barb, let's look into what we learned about these domestic extremist groups, their role in the January 6th violence, and the links of those groups to former President Trump directly or through his close associates like Roger Stone and General Flynn. In other words, what does it mean in terms of the culpability of Donald Trump?
Well, we heard from this witness, a man named Jason Van Tatenhove, who was a former spokesperson for the Oath Keepers. And, you know, as an insider like that, he was able to explain what the Oath Keepers are all about. And he said, make no mistake, they are a violent militia group. They want to start a war. They fantasize about a fight like that. They call themselves the Oath Keepers because they recruit mostly from former law enforcement and military members who took an oath to support and defend the Constitution. But they have this really warped view of what the Constitution says, in that they, Stuart Rhodes, who is their leader, according to the witness, said that, you know, he very much wanted President Trump to invoke the Insurrection Act and then call them up to active duty on January 6th so that they could fight back against the insurrection, meaning the vote in the Capitol. And so just a completely backwards view as to who were the insurrectionists and who were the militia. But, you know, these are not the National Guard militia that is referred to in the Second Amendment. These are private armies, and there is nothing legitimate about them. And to get to your question about connections to Donald Trump, you know, we saw some really interesting things there. We saw Roger Stone, a close associate, someone who was in the Trump War Room at the Willard Hotel on January 5th and 6th, taking his own initiation oath as a member of one of these groups. He talked about how I'm a Western chauvinist and I refuse to apologize for my contributions to the modern world. Stuart Rhodes, the leader of this group, was on an encrypted chat that called itself Friends of Stone. And boy, I'll tell you what, if I were the Justice Department, I would do everything I can to get my hands on that encrypted chat, because the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys have been charged with seditious conspiracy. This is a very, very serious charge. This is the closest charge we have in non-wartime with a declared war with a foreign government to treason. Yeah. It says that it is the use of force to oppose the government of the United States. And the Oath Keeper group and the Proud Boys group have been charged with that, for not just showing up at the Capitol and getting a little out of hand, but plotting, surveilling, leaving weapons surrounding the city so that they could be brought in, forming formations they called stacks, one that was looking for Mike Pence, another that was looking for Nancy Pelosi. If you can connect up Donald Trump to those groups and, you know, supersede the seditious conspiracy indictment to add people like Roger Stone and even Donald Trump, woo, that is, you know, the grand slam home run of all criminal charges.
You know, Barb, it's so fascinating that you say that, because DOJ already has cooperators in that case. There's an Arab Alabama man named Joshua James who's cooperating, and two more, a Georgia and a North Carolina man, so three Southerners. And I'll be interested whether we'll learn details as to whether the DOJ has been able to get into the chat through them, because I think you're dead on the money about what matters here.
And I'm hoping the Department of Justice is listening, because they should be getting into that, and they should be following the advice of Van Tattenhove, who said, let's not mince words. These are violent militia. And I'm going to put that on my Twitter feed under hashtag say this, not that.
Do you have a violent militia pin, Jill?
I don't.
We need to get Jill a militia pin.
Violent militia pin. I don't know. Violent militia, yes. Well, there is no other kind as far as I can tell. Kim, let me ask you, we've known for years that the domestic threat to our democracy is greater than the foreign one. So why is our federal response still focused on foreign threats, not just our federal response, but our federal laws? And how did the FBI miss the specific warning signs of the impending violence of January 6th?
Yeah, this is a great question, Jill. And it's something I have been looking into and reporting on for several years. For the past several years, if you look at the FBI threat assessment that's done every year, they have been saying, even during the Trump administration, even though they tried to downplay it a little bit, that the greatest terrorism threat to Americans are domestic. In fact, it's domestic extremism coming from the right wing. And that was, again, tried to be downplayed in the last administration, but that has been factually the threat. But since 9/11, after 9/11, the federal government really prioritized fighting terrorism as a top priority. And given what happened on 9/11, it was really focused on foreign terrorism. We got new laws, including the Patriot Act, which expanded the ability to investigate and charge on domestic terror charges. But at the same time, there was a lack of attention, a lack of adequate attention being paid to domestic extremism, even though it was growing, whether it was from certain militia groups, anti-government groups, hate groups, white supremacist groups. They're not all homogenous, but they are all dangerous. And we can see on January 6th, where a lot of these groups coordinate and come together, what the impact should be. So I've talked to a lot of people. Some call for new laws, point to the fact that domestic terrorism is not a federal crime. That's not something that can be investigated or charged. And so they believe that that hamstrings federal investigators. Others I talk to say, you know what? No, we don't need new laws. What we need is for the FBI to prioritize the laws that we already have, things like seditious conspiracy, and investigate and charge them. And most of all, for the FBI to collect and publish data on far right and other domestic violent incidents and other domestic extremist groups, and have a coordinated counterterrorism oversight function happening with federal agencies in a way that isn't happening right now. They say it's not a matter of not having resources or not having the laws. It's not having the will. It's not having the organization. A lot of people point to different reasons why this is so hard, including the fact that for a lot of law enforcement in a lot of parts of our country, they are more closely aligned to some of these anti-government or white nationalist groups than they would like to admit. And it's there's just not an appetite to go after them because they see them more as allies. But that is something I think that Christopher Wray from the top should really prioritize, as well as Merrick Garland, and really say, look, we're going to gather this data. We're going to require states to give us this data. We're going to coordinate, share information so that we don't get caught flat-footed in another January 6th type incident.
So Joyce and Barb, I had some related questions to ask you, and maybe just as a follow-up, because Kim kind of mentioned what I was had in mind, and that is I wanted to ask you, Joyce, about Congress's role is to pass new laws to combat what the January 6th committee is revealing, and we've learned a lot from those hearings. Are there any specific laws you think they should be considering adding to the arsenal of weapons we could use against domestic terrorists?
So domestic terrorism per se, and there are a lot of folks who have called for a domestic terrorism specific statute. In my experience as a prosecutor, I could always put together all of the tools that I needed from existing laws in order to prosecute militia groups or terror groups. So I'm not as firm on the need for a domestic terrorism statute for practical purposes, although I think it would set an important standard. And as Kim says, we need our leaders to speak with one voice on this issue. You know, we need folks like Chris Wray at the FBI to talk about this. We need the January 6th committee to talk about the information that they've gathered on domestic terror. But if we're thinking about the committee's larger purpose in putting together information on January 6th and taking proactive steps to prevent a repeat, I'm a big fan of Liz Cheney's suggestion. Those are words I never thought would come out of my mouth. But yes, I'm a big fan of Liz Cheney's suggestion that we should have enhanced penalties for presidential dereliction of duty. I think that's important. One of the keys at this point, though, is reexamining the 1887 Electoral Count Act, which governs the counting of electoral votes for president and Congress. That was, of course, the trigger point for all of Trump's crazy plans to hold on to power. And the statute was written a long time ago. It's in need of a serious tune-up if we're going to keep the Electoral College, although personally I'd rather like to see us dump the Electoral College at this point. I guess that's a topic for another day.
I bet. Let's all vote. Kim, are you for getting rid of the Electoral College?
I'm for reforming it.
Barb?
Yeah, I think so. You know, the devil's in the details, but you know, the whole idea of, frankly, Senate representation the same in Wyoming as it is in California, I think is undemocratic. And so I think a full examination of that is in order, but I think it's probably a political non-starter.
I agree with you on that. I think getting rid of the Electoral College is a great idea. I think dividing California into five states is also a great idea because they have enough people to justify having 10 senators. But anyway, okay, so Barb, until those laws are enacted, is there a way that the FBI and prosecutors can better focus the resources they already have?
Yeah, you know, one thing that is interesting is I think I disagree with Joyce in one respect, and that is a domestic terrorism statute. And I think it's needed not so much for prosecution of cases, because usually if you have people who are dead or hurt, you can charge them with state offenses. But it's to allow federal investigators to conduct a proactive investigation. If there is an investigation into a domestic terrorism group because they're planning something violent, then you can use a lot of surveillance tools. You can use wiretaps and use informants and all kinds of things that can help disrupt an attack before it occurs.
Yeah, but we've always been able to do that, right? When we did KKK cases, when we had sovereign citizen cases, I never had trouble getting the authority that I needed. So I don't have a problem with doing it. I'm just not sure, like, tell me what tools it would give me that I didn't already have.
Well, I'll tell you, I had cases involving mass shootings that there was no federal offense for. And so there are a lot of times when these cases evade federal investigations because there is not a federal offense on the table, or the only offense you can look at is, you know, a weapons offense, as opposed to something that encompasses the full scope of their conduct, which is, you know, I would say parallel to the international terrorism statute, which is violent conduct designed to mm-hmm. The loss of human life with a political motivation that, instead of transcending national boundaries, transcends state boundaries. But you know, one area, Joyce, where I think you could do this work that they just haven't, and this maybe requires more of a culture change at the FBI, which might be easier to achieve than a domestic terrorism statute, which will certainly be, you know, it's hard to pass anything through Congress these days, let alone something that, you know, both the left and the right has, I think, legitimate concerns about civil liberties violations. But one area, you may recall when Chris Wray testified and also Jill Sanborn, a high-level official at the Justice Department, they were asked, how is it that you didn't know about January 6th? And they said things like, well, we can't just go in willy-nilly and, you know, look at people's communications. We don't have the ability to do that. And that's really not quite right. But it is because I think they put such kid gloves on areas involving civil rights violations. And I also think it's because they don't investigate civil rights violations as robustly as they investigate terrorism. In terrorism cases, they are prowling around in chat rooms. They are, if they see something troubling, they introduce an informant and they start talking to that person. And then the person says, let's DM on Twitter. And then they do that. And the person pretends to be, you know, someone who's like-minded, a fellow traveler. And you don't see that in the civil rights arena when somebody's in a hate crimes group. And it's because they are really hands-off because of concerns about First Amendment rights, that if someone is expressing ideology about white supremacy or something of the like, that they should leave hands off. And I don't see any difference between the ideology expressed, whether it's white supremacy or an Islamic state. It's the conduct that you're looking at. It's when someone crosses over and starts expressing ideas of violence that you cross over. So I think you could do it within the civil rights program. But if you talk to people within the FBI, Joyce, even our friends who are there, who are really high-level people, they'll say, oh, you can't do that. That's civil rights. That's not part of the counterterrorism program. And I think they need to rethink domestic terrorism to encompass those things. And if they did, then we wouldn't need a domestic terrorism statute. We could look at these things as hate crimes, because if someone's plotting to kill people based on their race or their ethnicity or some other kind of thing, you could get to a lot of it. I guess I shouldn't say it would get all of it, because it wouldn't get all of the politically motivated anti-government sentiment. It would get the sentiment based on race or sexual orientation and some of those kinds of characteristics.
It's a really great idea. Barb McQuaid for next director of the FBI.
I love it.
That is a great idea. And I think that having something that clearly spells out that domestic terrorism warrants a wiretap would in itself be a major step forward, because I think the reluctance is unwarranted and unsafe for all of us. But anyway, Kim, how did the rise of militia, as we should be calling these extremist groups, and as the former Oath Keeper employee said it was, how did it happen in America, and how easily can the right-wing radicalization that happened on January 6th be repeated? And can it be stopped?
Yeah, I think it's important, and I'm glad you used the word radicalization. I was really grateful for the testimony of Stephen Ayers, who is not a member of the Oath Keepers or the Proud Boys or any other group. He was motivated by the words and lies of Donald Trump to go to the Capitol and rush the Capitol on that day. And he explained exactly why that happened. And, you know, he's cooperating with the committee. He expressed contrition and realized now that what he was told was a lie. But that's radicalization. You know, I don't think people think about it in that way. When they think about radicalization, they think about what happens with ISIS and what happens with Al-Qaeda. This is what happened to American citizens who were not previously associated with these groups. And I'm really glad that he expressed that in a way that America can understand. And if you didn't hear his testimony, go back and listen to it, because that can happen again. I think, but for the sharing of this information between federal law enforcement agencies, their cooperation in investigating it and encouraging people like that to come forward. I mean, he's charged with crimes as well. I'm sure his cooperation is probably urged in an effort to help his own case, but I think that's okay. I think having that is important. Having people like him speak out is important, so people understand how this works, and that this isn't just people. If you're not an Oath Keeper, that doesn't mean that you're immune from it. Or if the people you know aren't Oath Keepers, it doesn't mean that they're immune from it.
Exactly. I thought Mr. Ayers' testimony was really powerful when he was talking about, I got radicalized by social media and I got off it. And I started doing my own research, and then I realized that I had been misled. So that was, I thought, an important point that he made.
Love the night? Reach for Zen After Dark, a limited cocktail-inspired series for those who get up when the sun goes down. Try Zen's Mojito, spiced cider, and espresso martini nicotine pouches. Find them at select retailers. Available while supplies last.
Zin After Dark. Bring on the night. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
If you run a Shopify store, listen up. Shopify's got you covered for selling, but when your shipping volume grows and you're juggling multiple plugins just to get orders out the door, you need tools that can keep up. Stop duct taping your shipping workflow and use the tools that work better together, like Shopify and ShipStation. Think of ShipStation as Shopify's dedicated shipping partner. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels to save you time and money by automating the entire order fulfillment process, from syncing your orders all the way through inventory management and returns. Automate the rate browser to select the lowest rates on shipments, with discounts up to 90% off major carriers like USPS, UPS, and FedEx. No wonder businesses that use ShipStation grow 3 times faster on average and ship 15 times more orders. See how ShipStation can help you scale and boost your Shopify sales. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
Well, Steve Bannon's trial is set to begin this week. That really is a pass the popcorn moment, I think. He's charged with contempt of Congress.
And I have a popcorn pin.
Beautiful. Well, you should be wearing it. But it seemed like a good time to discuss some witness issues that have been in the news. You know, for Bannon, of course, he refused to comply with that subpoena to testify before the January 6th committee back in October, asserting executive privilege. We've also now seen Senator Lindsey Graham challenge a subpoena from Fulton County DA Fani Willis on the basis that it is privileged under the speech or debate clause of the Constitution. And then this past week, Liz Cheney announced at the hearing at the end of that last January 6th hearing, she's got this way, right, of dropping like that last little cliffhanger, that little blockbuster, like to tune in next week for the Netflix show, that a witness received a phone call from Donald Trump and that the committee has referred that matter to DOJ for investigation. Ooh, so let's talk about each of those a little bit. Jill, you're our executive privilege expert, having participated in the case that defined executive privilege in the U.S. versus Nixon case. Based on the court's recent rulings there in Washington, does Bannon have any defense under executive privilege?
No, he does not. And to put it simply, and the judge was actually quite clear, and the defense attorney said, what's the point in going to trial here if there's no defenses? And I would answer Mr. Schoen that maybe there isn't a point and it's time to plead guilty. The judge's order in the Bannon case just repeated everything that we know about executive privilege. And I bet that everyone listening knows all these rules, but there is a crime fraud exception, which this would probably fall into. It's a privilege that belongs to the current POTUS, not the former POTUS. So there never was a possibility. And the times involved here, Bannon was not an employee of the government. He wasn't in a position that you could have asserted executive privilege, even if it had happened while Donald Trump was president. So there's a lot of reasons why there's no privilege here and that it was absurd. And then finally, of course, even if there was privilege, it doesn't mean you don't have to show up, that you can just thumb your nose and say, this is going to be the misdemeanor from hell, and I'm going to make sure that we call in everybody from the January 6th committee and Nancy Pelosi. And he would have had to go in and, in response to a question, say, I claim privilege as to that. And then there's also the reason that Donald Trump says he didn't actually ever invoke privilege for Bannon. So I don't know if he's throwing Bannon under the bus, but it certainly sounds like that to me. So in this case, as in the Nixon case, the final thing is that in a criminal proceeding or in a Senate hearing or a House hearing, the public interest will outweigh the privilege, and it can be waived as it was in Watergate. The president was told he had no privilege because it was too important and the evidence needed to be presented in our criminal case. And the same would hold true here.
Yeah, this is what we used to refer to in my former office as a slow motion guilty plea. Like, you know, he even said, well, there's no defense yet. What's the point of going to trial if there's no defense? And the judge is like, well, yeah, exactly. You know, you have a right to plead guilty if you want to. We'll see how that goes. Well, next let's talk about Lindsey Graham's argument. So the privilege arguments keep getting, you know, more and more creative, shall we say. he has said that he is shielded from testifying in Georgia there by the speech or debate clause. Kim, what on earth is the speech or debate clause? And does Graham have any argument here?
So the speech and debate clause basically shields lawmakers from liability from what they say and do based on their actual legitimate legislative activity. So people can be rhetorical when they're giving a speech on the House or Senate floor, right? And they can't be sued for libel or something based on that. They can debate each other, and those debates can get heated, and they can't really be, if it's in advancement of legislative purposes, which is pretty broad, then they're generally okay. What it does not do is shield against criminal acts or other liability or unlawfulness. You cannot engage in unlawful behavior and then turn around and say, nope, speech and debate clause, I'm covered. So in this case, if he pressured Brad Raffensperger in Georgia to try to reverse the results of the election there, for example, that would not be covered by speech and debate. And like other things, the way to assert this would be for Senator Graham to cooperate with this investigation and then in response to certain questions say, well, you know, there's the speech and debate clause. I think I object based on that, and I think that it isn't applicable. Again, he still needs to cooperate. Didn't he claim in the beginning he was going to cooperate, and then suddenly he's like, oh, nope, can't. I'm a senator, so peace out. No, it doesn't work that way.
Peace out. You know, it's kind of like saying, you know, when I play Monopoly and I get this get out of jail free card, I get to present it and I actually get out of jail free in the game of Monopoly. And yeah. Then it's like he's out in the real world and saying, oh, look, I have this card. Doesn't this keep me out of jail for free? Like, no, that's a game. So wrong venue. Go back and play your little game. Doesn't work here.
Yeah.
I fully expect him to have to testify. All right. Now, Kim, is it speech and debate clause or is it speech or debate clause? What's the debate?
That's a good question. I have always said speech and debate, and I'm looking at Congress's own website when they're talking about how it applies to members of Congress, and they say that it's the speech and debate clause. Mm-hmm. The actual language of the Constitution says something different. I believe that you took a look at that, Barb.
Yeah, that does say speech or debate, but I think, you know, you'll hear people talk about it either way, and don't let anybody tell you they know the right answer, because it's referred to as both. The text is speech or debate. If you're a textualist, I guess you say speech or debate, but a lot of people refer to it as speech and debate, so I think they're both right.
So, Barb, the bottom line, though, Barb, is that it doesn't matter whether it's speech and debate or speech or debate. It does not apply to a phone call by Lindsey Graham to Brad Raffensperger.
Yeah.
No how, no way.
I'm with you, Jill. All right. Well, finally, let's get to the last one. Joyce, what do you make of Liz Cheney's statement about the call a witness received from Donald Trump? She said at the end of the hearing there, and then further saying that it had been referred to the Justice Department for investigation. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, this is so interesting, right? Because it could be a crime, but we can't really say whether it is or not based on the limited information we have. The baseline is that Trump reached out to a former support staff person in the White House, and that's pretty interesting because this was a guy who barely talked to his kids, right? I mean, there was that whole thing on January 6th where the kids had to call Mark Meadows to get in touch with him. So it's sort of hard to believe, you know, that he was just reaching out to somebody on the support staff at this point in time. But here's the problem, and Barb, you and I have talked about this a little bit. If DOJ was treating this like a criminal investigation, it seems really unlikely to me that Liz Cheney would have raised it so quickly at the hearing. And DOJ would have actually been following up with some sort of a covert phone call. If somebody had brought this to us when we were prosecutors, I think we would have said, great, let's wire the target up and have him return the phone call and see what we can get on tape. And maybe that did happen and very quickly, and then Liz Cheney spoke about it. But I'm sort of reading the fact that she spoke about it as at least some indication that DOJ is not pursuing this. And that raises my eyebrows a little bit, because if this had been any defendant, just, you know, a drug case or a bank robbery or anything like that where this was happening, your hard instinct as a prosecutor is to follow up on witness intimidation. And it's the kind of thing where I have seen prosecutors skip Friday afternoon drinks after work, you know, for everybody to stick around and circle the wagons and protect our witnesses. So I think that this is a little bit concerning. I hope that DOJ acted very quickly and will wake up one morning to some sort of a conclusion to this setting. But I've got to say, I'm not sure at this point. The statute is very broad and expansive, though. 18 U.S.C. 1512 typically covers witness tampering, witness intimidation. And it's important to note that it's broad enough to cover an unsuccessful attempt to intimidate a witness. It would cover any kind of effort not only to prevent testimony, but to influence testimony, to alter testimony, even merely seeking to delay testimony can ring the bell under this statute. So lots of latitude for prosecutors to run here if they're inclined to.
Yeah. And I also think you don't have to look at this in a vacuum. You know, I know it's certainly not enough to say Trump tried to call somebody, therefore it's obstruction of justice. You know, that alone is not going to be enough. But I do think there's value in investigating. I mean, imagine if it's somebody that he's never called before. You know, I'm the coat check guy. But I saw something and testimony came up about a story, and Trump's thinking, who else was there? Oh man, the coat check guy was there. I got to make sure the coat check guy doesn't talk. He's never called the coat check guy in his life. And, you know, when people are in positions of power, I find so often that they are so arrogant that to them, the coat check guy is just invisible. And so they say all kinds of things, blatantly incriminating things in front of the coat check guy because they don't see him. They're invisible to them. They're unimportant. They're insignificant. They barely exist. And so the idea that coat check guy gets a call from the former president of the United States who's never called him before, and it happens to come right after some testimony comes out involving him, I don't know. I think that you might be able to draw some inferences there. I think it also matters whether other witnesses have been contacted, and Cassidy Hutchinson's, I guess, has said, I think they've identified she is the one who has been contacted by intermediaries. So I think it's worth looking at. But I agree with you, Joyce, that I think saying this out loud and not, you know, putting up a wire or taking the call says mostly, hey, Trump, we're on to you. Knock it off.
Love the night? Reach for Zin After Dark, a limited cocktail-inspired series for those who get up when the sun goes down. Try Zin's Mojito, Spiced Cider, and Espresso Martini nicotine pouches. Find them at select retailers, available while supplies last. Zin After Dark. Bring on the night. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
If you run a Shopify store, listen up. Shopify has got you covered for selling, but when your shipping volume grows and you're juggling multiple plugins just to get orders out the door, you need tools that can keep up. Stop duct taping your shipping workflow and use the tools that work better together, like Shopify and ShipStation. Think of ShipStation as Shopify's dedicated shipping partner. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels to save you time and money by automating the entire order fulfillment process, from syncing your orders all the way through inventory management and returns. Automate the rate browser to select the lowest rates on shipments, with discounts up to 90% off major carriers like USPS, UPS, and FedEx. No wonder businesses that use ShipStation grow 3 times faster on average and ship 15 times more orders. See how ShipStation can help you scale and boost your Shopify sales. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
Since the Dobbs decision struck down Roe versus Wade, those seeking to protect access to abortion care on the federal, state, and local level have been busy trying to find ways around state abortion bans. So, Joyce, let's start by talking about some of the state and local action. I've been really interested to see how some law enforcement officials and prosecutors say they won't file charges against, for example, medical workers who conduct abortions on their patients. Is this something they actually have the power to do? And can abortion care providers depend on that?
You know, this is such a good question, and I live in one of the counties where my district attorney has announced that he won't prosecute. I value the sentiment. I'm not sure how much it achieves in practice, and I think folks need to be very cautious because, for instance, I would expect that if you live in a red state, and I do, that my conservative state attorney general might be really unhappy about this and might decide, as he is authorized to do under state law, to come in and prosecute cases on his own where a district attorney declines to. So I think that this is sort of a buyer beware situation. And even beyond that, you know, these sorts of promises are good for as long as a DA is in office. They're obviously not binding on their successors. So if they're defeated in an election or even, you know, if they're run over by a bus, God forbid, tomorrow morning, that promise could go out with them. I think this is a good time for people to be very cautious about what they rely on if they're concerned. I will say, Kim, something interesting that I've noticed in the medical community here is a lot of doctors and a lot of providers who have just had enough and don't really care. And I suspect we will see some early challenges, maybe involving medical providers who decide to give women life-saving care, no matter what the personal consequences are. And those could be some of the early and very interesting test cases.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I will be watching that very closely. Jill, I want to talk a bit about what's happening at the federal level. I mean, this week the House passed a bill to offer some protections for abortion rights, but it's not expected to go anywhere in the Senate with the filibuster still in place. But let's talk about other things that are happening. For example, President Biden's executive order on abortion. What effect will that have?
It will have some effect, and it's a good start. He has focused on a number of things that I think are very important. One is to make sure that medicated abortion is available, no matter what state you're in. And medicated abortion actually is responsible for about half of all abortions in this country. So that's a pretty big group. And keeping it available in states that have now barred abortion would be a major thing. He's also made sure that hospitals that have federal monies that get anything under Medicare or Medicaid understand that they must provide emergency care to anyone who presents at the hospital in extremis for any reason, including a partial abortion that's, you know, sort of underway or an ectopic pregnancy. They must provide that care. And this isn't a change in the law. That was just sort of a reminder that was sent to hospitals that get federal money to remind them that they must allow doctors to provide those kinds of care. And so those are you know, good things. There are a number of things that are happening outside of any of the things we've talked about. In addition to what the president has announced in his executive order, states and localities are taking some actions. Michigan, thank you, Barbara, we're very happy it's Michigan, has proposed an amendment to their own constitution to protect abortion.
Proud signer of the petition right here.
Did you? Oh, good for you. And they have enough signatures to get it on the ballot. And I think it's going to play a pretty big role in the November election. So that's a pretty important thing. Although ballot initiatives have pros and cons and they can get lost. And Arizona tried one, but it was badly written. And it included a viability standard. And then they get challenged in court. And so that can be hard. It's always hard to change the Constitution. But states are also creating access networks with other states. And Illinois, which I'm proud to be part of, is a place that many states are sending patients and they're sending doctors along with it. And so I think that those are the kinds of things that will help to make it more available. Injunctions are being sought against laws. The Louisiana law is in sort of limbo right now. It was banned. The ban was rejected. The injunction was granted. Then it was taken away. Then it's been granted again. So I don't know how that's going to end up turning out. A personhood bill has been defeated in Arizona. which would have really ended things because it would have granted personhood to a fetus. But the lawsuit of an aborted fetus has been sued by the father. The doctor has been sued for having taken away his child. And that case is still pending. So there are things that need to be done at the federal level, at the state level, and from local prosecutors.
Yeah, and it's important to know, too, that it's not just Democratic lawmakers and executives that are doing this in Massachusetts, for example. It has a Roe Act. You know, it's to me, I thought, oh, well, they've done everything they could. And the Republican governor there actually signed an executive order to protect providers from being from liability from other states where they somehow make it illegal to travel to provide care or to receive care, which, again, I don't know how that's constitutional, but it's important to acknowledge that. So, Barb, the DOJ, Department of Justice, created a task force on abortion this week as well. Tell us about that.
Yeah, you know, this was a task force. It's being led by Vanita Gupta. You know, she's a name people probably know, but, or at least should know. She's the Associate Attorney General, long, deep career in civil rights. I don't know that this happens without someone like her in this leadership position, you know, number three position in the Justice Department. And, you know, you don't have a lot of women who have risen historically to that level. And so I think it's significant that she's there. But this task force has been charged with monitoring and evaluating state and local legislation and considering legal action against states that ban abortion medication or travel out of state for an abortion, which would be under the Constitution illegal. And so I think that if laws are passed in some of these states and we see these kinds of interference with rights, that we're going to see lawsuits from the Justice Department. And that's where the rubber's going to meet the road, I think. You know, Brett Kavanaugh wrote in his concurring opinion in Dobbs that nothing about this opinion should in any way affect the right to travel. But of course, that is based on that same foundation that Roe was, the right to an abortion, which was substantive due process, that idea of fundamental rights that cannot be taken away, even though they're not enumerated under the Ninth Amendment. Certain rights that have existed traditionally and historically cannot be, we should, you know, presume that they are still there, that they have not been taken away. And so the right to travel is one of those. And so I think that'll be really interesting. So I think if a state passes one of these laws, we can expect this task force to file a lawsuit, and which will, you know, no doubt percolate up. And it's an interesting issue because if there's no right to travel, that means there's also no right to travel out of state to, say, you know, participate in gambling in Las Vegas and, you know, other economic activities. And so, you know, it'll be an interesting face-off between whether people feel more strongly about their, you know, religious views about protecting a fetus or whether they feel more strongly about the economic rights that would get limited by controlling someone's right to to travel. Although, who am I assuming there will be consistency, right? Maybe they'll just say you can't travel for an abortion, but you can travel to gamble.
Oh, man, we are shocked to hear that there is travel happening for gambling. So I just want to ask all of you guys, so people who support these abortion bans or abortion opponents claim that some of these actions, particularly the federal actions to try to get around these abortion bans, are violating federalism principles by imposing on states' ability to regulate abortion. What do you guys say to that? Do they have a point? Is it not the role of the federal government to step in and say, hey, states, you can't do this?
It isn't, in my mind, a valid argument because I value the federal role. And I think the federal role is to guarantee certain rights. Now, it's a little complicated now because not only has the Supreme Court said there is no constitutional right to an abortion, but they've also taken a case that would say that basically the states are independent of everything and you can't even review state on even election things. So I hesitate answering because under this Supreme Court, almost anything is possible. But I think that our founders, in the balance between state rights and federal rights, gave certain rights to the federal government that in this case would prevail, and that this is not a violation of states' rights to have federal action to protect the rights of women. I still think what we need is the Equal Rights Amendment, and I'm going to work to make sure that we try to get that adopted because it has been approved by the right number of states, and it should become part of the Constitution immediately.
I'll interject just briefly to agree with Jill that in federalism, there's a role for state governments and there's a role for federal governments. And if the state should overreach on its rights, then it is the job of the Justice Department to step in and protect those federal rights. You know, for example, just as we were just talking about the right to travel, if a state, and Missouri is talking about this, other states are talking about this, says it is illegal for you to leave our state to go obtain an abortion, which is illegal in a neighboring state, that is a violation of a constitutional right to travel. And I would expect our Justice Department to fight to protect that right. So I think each sovereign has its lane, and there's nothing about this task force that is violating the lane of the federal government. Nothing about the HHS work, nothing about the executive order. All of those things are appropriate exercises of federal power.
You know, like Jill, I'm very worried about what the Supreme Court might do, but even in the Dobbs decision itself, the court was explicit about saying that what they were doing was sending the option back to the states about whether abortion would be legal in its borders or not. And they explicitly contemplated that there might be differing laws across states. And Justice Kavanaugh was explicit about the fact that women would be able to travel. So this notion at this point of raising federal concerns is not only, as you, Jill, and you, Barb, have pointed out, not well grounded in the law, it seems to run contrary to what the court told us we could expect as a country. I would hope that the court itself would honor this very, I mean, this is a low bar that the court set for protecting women, but, you know, this is the bar. I would hope that they would honor it.
Love the night? Reach for Zin After Dark, a limited cocktail-inspired series for those who get up when the sun goes down. Try Zin's Mojito, Spiced Cider, and Espresso Martini nicotine pouches. Find them at select retailers, available while supplies last. Zin After Dark. Bring on the night. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
If you run a Shopify store, listen up. Shopify's got you covered for selling, but when your shipping volume grows and you're juggling multiple plugins just to get orders out the door, you need tools that can keep up. Stop duct taping your shipping workflow and use the tools that work better together, like Shopify and ShipStation. Think of ShipStation as Shopify's dedicated shipping partner. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels to save you time and money by automating the entire order fulfillment process, from syncing your orders all the way through inventory management and returns. Automate the rate browser to select the lowest rates on shipments, with discounts up to 90% off major carriers like USPS, UPS, and FedEx. No wonder businesses that use ShipStation grow 3 times faster on average and ship 15 times more orders. See how ShipStation can help you scale and boost your Shopify sales. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
This has been one of those weeks that just elicits so many questions. I think that's why we've had so much to talk about today. Even for us, the questions just really come fast and furious in a week like this. And we have had great questions from our listeners to answer. If you've got questions for us, please email them to us at sistersinlaw@politicon.com or tweet using #sistersinlaw. And if we don't get to your questions during the show, keep an eye on our Twitter feeds throughout the week because we'll try to answer as many of them as we can. Our first question this week comes from Lindsay. And Barb, I think this one is meant for you. Lindsay asks if we can explore the distinction between, Lindsay asks if we can explore the distinction between manslaughter and negligent homicide, which Lindsay says they guess doesn't apply as well, but they're not sure why. And they're asking how good this line of reasoning is if one's goal is some sort of basic human accountability. Is there some hope to be held out? What do you think, Barb?
Well, welcome to first-year criminal law, Lindsay. This is a big topic. of discussion. It's probably ringing some bells for all of you, right, who sat through criminal law as a first-year law student, as most do. You know, there are all these different gradations of homicide. So the worst is a crime committed with malice aforethought, a deliberate murder. You lie in wait and you poison them or shoot them or kill them or in some other way. But then you also have these kinds of accidental deaths. And so manslaughter could be one. It's an involuntary death, but somebody ends up dead. And then there's also negligent homicide, which is also an accidental death. And there is a gradation between the two. Manslaughter means I acted recklessly. Now, each state can define their statutes as they want to, but typically, manslaughter requires a level of recklessness, which means that a person disregarded a risk of which they were aware. So say, I don't know, hypothetically, a president is aware that there is thousands of people in a mob attacking the U.S. Capitol, resulting in death, and you do nothing. You sit idly by when you have an affirmative duty to do that. If you're aware of that risk, that could be manslaughter. Negligent homicide, on the other hand, is a slightly lower standard. That is, a person disregarded a risk of which he should have been aware. So maybe, say hypothetically, a president is sitting in the White House watching on television, and he is oblivious to the fact that people may be dying inside, and he just thinks it's all a great show. And he was not aware of any actual risk, but he really should have been. That would be negligent homicide.
So that's a fascinating sort of romp through first year law school and criminal law. I'll be interested to see if we have reason to revisit that, Barb. Our next question comes from Judy. And Judy says, why is it that ignorance of the law is, quote, no excuse, yet we hear so much about needing to prove intent, especially when it comes to prosecuting Donald Trump? How is this not a double standard? Different statutes, different standards, she asks. What can we tell Judy, y'all?
Oh, that's a great question. I really love this question. I will try to give it a shot, although I am not as good at criminal law, as good a criminal law professor as Barb is. I wish my criminal law professor was as cool as you, Barb. So you are correct that ignorance of the law is no excuse. But many laws, not all of them, but many criminal statutes have an element of something that's called mens rea, which means you have to have the intent to commit the act, which is illegal. That's different from intent based on your knowledge that it's illegal. So an example is, let's say I had no idea that bank robbery was illegal. Like anything involved in a bank robbery broke any law. I just did not know. I thought you could just go rob a bank whenever you want to. And I go and I rob a bank. The intent isn't to break a law. The intent is to take the money. So as long as the prosecutors prove the intent to commit the action of sticking up this bank and taking the money, that's the mens rea that's required, not knowing that it is illegal. So I understand how that's confusing, but they're two different things.
Our last question is about a story I know we've all been following closely for the last 24 hours. This story that the Secret Service reportedly, according to their inspector general, that they deleted some text messages, and those text messages happen to have been on January 5 and January 6. And so the question is, what do you make of these erasures? Is there something nefarious or is it innocent? What do you think?
There's no way it's innocent. That's too much of a coincidence that it happened to be on January 5th and 6th. Yes, things can go wrong with computers. We all know that. And it is possible to lose maybe from one device. But they're not lost from the backup cloud or from the backup mainframe. I don't believe that that's possible. And it's so weird. It's like the 18 and a half minute gap, which happened exactly at the moment in a tape of many, many hours, but the 18-minute gap was exactly when Watergate was being discussed. Everything else was fine on the tape. That's not an accidental erasure. It was obviously deliberate. Or like maybe how many hours was missing from the calendar? That's not an accident when it's at a time that's already suspicious. So I would say that we have a lot to look at here. It's certainly investigation worthy, and that's what should be happening. It must be investigated.
What do y'all think?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's mighty convenient. I mean, we won't know until the investigation is complete. But yes, my thoughts when that happened were how convenient.
Did you see the really over-the-top statement that the Secret Service communications director? It really sounded like it came from the pen of Trump. But, you know, there's one thing in there. And, you know, listeners always try to share with you thoughts about how to spot a bad argument. And one of them is this overly broad argument that maybe technically accurate, but I think potentially misleading. It says that the Office of Inspector General requested electronic communications for the first time on February 26, 2021, after the migration was well underway. So, Joyce, I know you and I have been involved in these big migrations in a huge agency, thousands of employees. They don't like change out everybody's phone on the same day. They say, you know, a third of you are getting your new phone on this day, and, you know, this office is getting their new phones on that day. And it takes months to do one of these rollouts. So the rollout began on February 26th. But what the inspector general is saying is the particular phones that we want were not erased until after that day. And the statement does not address that. So I think there is certainly room here for further investigation.
You know, I'm always willing to entertain the notion that incompetence is involved.
Sure, of course.
When we're talking about government. And Barb, something I
human
know
error.
You remember from, yeah, I mean, you know, and it's incompetence. It's certainly a lack of judgment. Somebody in the leadership at the Secret Service should have put the brakes on this the minute January 6th yep. occurred, right? They should have said there's going to be stuff on our phones that we need. I mean, the Secret yep, Service, their sure. policy is to not text. And that, frankly, and it's worth pointing out, I think, that in the early years of the Obama administration, there's a memo called the Ogden memo. It's a records retention memo that's directed primarily towards criminal investigative teams. But it says, you know, you really shouldn't use text messages or emails for substantive communications because sometimes we have to turn those things over in discovery. And so the best practice is not to use them for that. And the Secret Service is included under that memo. And that's a mentality that sort of filters out from criminal investigative teams, even to folks on protection details. You don't want to get into a situation where your emails or your text messages become discoverable down the road. And the service also, for security reasons, because text messages can be hacked, tries to not use text or email. But that said, and given the fact that government technology seems to always be a decade behind the private sector, it's really hard to believe that with all the experience that we had in like 2005 and 6 with these early rollouts of first generation, you know, well, the old BlackBerries and first generation iPhones, that they haven't figured out by now that before you do, before you move to a new phone, you back up all your data, right? That's what you do at home when you get a new phone. You back up all your data. And there are reasons, including criminal discovery, that this stuff has to all be backed up. So my thought is that the Secret Service might find these text messages and be able to produce them. I remember there was some question when the Trump administration was concerned about Pete Strzok and Lisa Page at the FBI, and there were some missing text messages, and the FBI was able to recover those. I know that they've done that in criminal cases. I expect that whatever the Secret Service agents were talking about should be available pretty rapidly, and that information will become accessible.
So, Barb, you mentioned something, and Joyce, you mentioned something that make me want to respond. One, deliberately misleading may be in that constitutional Supreme Court case that says deliberately misleading but literally true, which is what you said it was, is not perjury. But I also want to raise the issue of the coincidence of the dates and the fact that the Secret Service agent who was the chief of staff, deputy chief of staff for Donald Trump, was a Secret Service agent before that and has returned as the deputy director of the Secret Service. And I know this may sound conspiracy theory-like, and I don't mean it in that way, but again, it's just one of those things that makes me say, it needs to be investigated. We need to see if we can find the missing texts and we need to see if there's anything nefarious about why they are missing.
Thank you for listening to Hashtag Sisters-in-Law with Jill Winebanks, Kimberly Atkins-Store, Barb McQuaid, and me, Joyce Vance. You can send in your questions by email to sistersinlaw@politicon.com or tweet them for next week's show using hashtag sistersinlaw. Go to politicon.com/merch to buy our pale blue tee, hoodie, and other goodies, and please support this week's sponsors, HelloFresh, Noom, Helix, Policy Genius, and Osea Malibu. You can find their links in the show notes, but please support them. They really help make the show happen. To keep up with us every week, follow hashtag sisters-in-law on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, and please give us a 5-star review. It really helps others find the show. See you next week with another episode, hashtag sisters-in-law.
Baba Sue.
You were doing so well. You almost nailed it.
It sounded like Babaloo.
Babaloo, I was thinking that too. I thought Ricky Ricardo. Babaloo.
Sorry. Oh, I was doing so good on that. Do I have to do that whole thing again?
Let's take it from the top, Ms. Winebanks.
I'm sorry. Get the image of Ricky Ricardo out of your head. I'm sorry I did that.
I know. I was saying it. It's Babaloo.
This is sounding more like Lucy with Vitamita Benjamin.
Oh, my God. I'm not going to be able to stop laughing now.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and 4-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.